my name's Beth and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 2nd, 1989, and I have a sponsor and a home group, and very grateful to be here. Thank you, Billy, for asking me to come out here. We've had a long relationship, years and years and years, and it's really good to see us. We went over here too. And it's funny how in Alcoholics Anonymous you meet people all over the place in those friendships that happen here. I'm so grateful to be with you all. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being an alcoholic. I never thought I would say that, but I do love being an alcoholic today in recovery. And I love being with people that, you know, I say this all the time when I come into a meeting about Alcoholics Anonymous. When I'm with people of my type, you will walk into some meetings where you kind of wonder what they have, but this is not that place. When I walked in here, I knew I was with my people. I know I'm amongst alcoholics. And that's a really good feeling. It's a really good feeling. It's a safe place. And my whole life I was looking for that place. You know, I was looking for why my insides felt so different than your outsides looked. And, you know, I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I feel at home. And that might not have been the case the first day I walked in here, but it sure is true today. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 18 years old, and I had been in and out for years, and I really believed that if I just stopped drinking, everything would be fine. My life would be great, and that would be true if I wasn't an alcoholic, but that is so far from what happened to me. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, did nothing, and got real sick. And that's how I learned what I was suffering from. I started drinking when I was, I guess, 13 years old. And like I said, you know, up until that point in my life, I felt different than everybody else, that I perceived everybody else looked. I tried various things from a very early age. And I don't know, I truly don't know if I was born alcoholic. I don't know how this if it's genetic. I don't know. It doesn't matter. All I know is I am one. And I know from a very early age I felt not right. I did not feel like I fit in this world. I felt like I needed to do things to get attention. I don't know why. I had plenty of attention, but it never felt like enough. I tried to break bones to get a cast on so people would sign it so I'd feel loved at school. I tried various things. I would take hot showers, run outside, try to get the flu. I mean, why would you do that? I don't know, but it seemed like a good idea to get attention. I was strange. I was really close with my mom. My dad was an alcoholic. He's sober now, so I can say that about him. And he drank, so he was vacant a lot in my early childhood. I started when I was, I guess, gosh, I don't even know, 10 years old. My dad told me he didn't believe what I heard him say was he didn't believe in God and we weren't going to church anymore. I don't know that that's actually what he said. That's what I heard. And I remember thinking, you know, I started doing all this stuff, like getting Bibles and reading these books. And one of my friends was a Mormon. And I thought, well, I'll become a Mormon. So I went to church with her for a weekend. Which, if any of you all have ever gone to church with a Mormon, it's a lot of church on the weekend. It's all weekend. And so by Sunday night, I was kind of done with that. And, you know, later on, a couple years later, I went to visit my cousin who was a born-again Christian. And I thought, okay, well, I'll become born again. And I did that for the week that I was visiting her. And I was like, this is way too much for me. And then I found drugs and alcohol, and that was my God. And that worked a whole lot quicker than either of those religions ever did for me. And so, you know, what that tells me about myself is I was seeking something. There was something not right, and I needed something bad, and I didn't know what it was. I had no clue what it was. I didn't know it was a God. I just knew that it didn't feel right on the inside. I needed it to go away quick because it was getting real bad on the inside. And the first thing I used actually was not alcohol. The first thing I could get my hands on was a box of Vibrin and a bottle of butane. And then the next thing I got my hands on was Mad Dog 2020. The bottles were flat. They fit real well in your pants, and you can steal them real easy from the drugstore. And I started skipping school and stealing from the People's Drug that was right across the the road from my intermediate school, and that's when I started drinking. And my first drink, you know, they talk about that line, that we crossed this line. I have no idea when I crossed it. I know that my first drink may have been the only, I don't even know if it was normal. I took two drinks of whiskey. That was my first drink. I threw up in a trash can and I went to sleep. And that was probably the closest thing to a normal drink that I have ever taken in my life. From there on, you know, everything else was I was trying to get someplace. And I say this all the time, you know, if I could have stopped, I remember distinctly, like I would be drinking, and I remember drinking around three beers. I'm a beer drinker. I love beer. Beer gets a bad rap, but in my mind, I felt like I could control it a little better. Like when I drank liquor, I did really, really, really stupid things. But when I drank beer, I didn't get quite as drunk, so I didn't do quite as bad things. Now, if liquor was all that was there, I would drink it, but I preferred beer. Anyway, so I would get to my third beer, and I would say, you know, I think this is great, and that feeling would come over me, and everything was good. Life was good. The color came on. And if I could have just stopped right there, I would have had it made. But I could never stop there. I always overshot the mark, always. And, you know, I would want to. I would have every intention of stopping there. You know, I'm just going to hang out and drink a couple. Next morning, it would be like, what the hell did I do? You know, how did I end up here again? And I had no clue what was wrong with me. I started drinking when I was 13. I have been in and out of institutions pretty much every 6 months from the time I started drinking. So by the time I was 14 or 15, I had some clue there was something not right with me. I had been told multiple times that I'd have these diagnoses. I would be depressed with possible alcoholism. And there was always that possible alcoholism thrown in there, but all these other things added on to it. I knew something was wrong with me. To me, alcoholism meant that I could drink more than most people and still drive a car, still function. That wasn't true, but that's what I thought of myself, that, you know, I could drink more than most people and still hold conversations. And that's what alcoholic was to me. I really had no idea what I had. I started running away. Like I said, I was a pretty good kid up until that point. I started running away to Lorton, Virginia, which at that time, you know, it's beautiful now if you ever go to Lorton. It's a really nice place. It was not a really nice place when I was running away to it. It was a jail and an old country store and a lot of condemned homes. And I grew up in Oakton, Virginia, and I would hitchhike down 123. I have a 13-year-old daughter, and I think about I was that age doing that, and how crazy that is when I look at her. And but I was having fun. You know, I had arrived. I did not care at all that my parents were worried sick where their daughter was. I didn't even have the thought of it. And if I did, I would blame them for the reason I had to run away was because they did this. You know, I had this lie that I had come up with that my father wanted a son instead of a daughter. He never, ever said that, ever. But I convinced myself of that to make the things that I was doing okay. I'm sure a lot of you have experienced this where you, it's like you take an action, you get this gut reaction, you know it's the wrong thing to do, but then something takes over and it's like, I'm doing it anyways, and you go ahead and you do it. And somehow it becomes okay, and it gets worse and worse and worse. And that's how it was for me. I kept making excuses for why it was okay to take these actions that I knew were not okay and somehow made them right. Whether it was, you know, it's usually blaming somebody else. It was either God or you. And that was my life. You know, I started running away these places. My parents started getting smart. My mom joined this thing called Tough Love, which was pretty much the end of my running away. And in Tough Love, they told her to start locking me out of the house, to stop buying me mopeds to run away on, to stop buying me new clothes, to locking me up. And that's what she started doing. She started calling the cops on me. You know, up until that point, I could manipulate them. They bought into what I was telling them, that it's their fault. And they tried really hard. They had no clue. It was like one day I was this good kid, and one day I'm this crazy, insane beast. And who's running away to Lorton, Virginia with these 30-year-old men. And these guys would have bathtubs full of grain alcohol and freezers full of PCP. And I, you know, this was, like, amazing. All I had to do was get there. And that was pretty easy to get there, too. And, you know, we would go there and just it'd be drunk and high. And life was good. And that was as far as the thought went for other people. And so I started getting locked up after about, gosh, 2 or 3 months of doing this. And I went to my first place, which was a hospital that treated me for depression and possible alcoholism. I was there for a month. I went to one AA meeting a week. And the funny thing is, I was talking to somebody before about jails and institutions, and you never know how you're going to affect people. I don't remember anything the people that came in who brought those meetings to me. I don't remember a word they said other than they were from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember going and sitting there for an hour and listening to them, and that was it. I'd be there for 30 days, and I'd get out, and, I mean, this was a cycle for me. You know, I go in there, I get my stuff together, I come out, and it'd start all over again. The first time I was sent to, for my freshman year of high school, I was sent to a place called Northwest Center for Community Mental Health, which is not a real cool place to tell your friends you're going to high school. And when I was there, I was with seriously crazy people. Like, I am mentally not right, no question about it. But these people were married to Stevie Nicks. Like, I may not be right, but I am here most of the time in reality. These people were not. And the sick thing is I felt just a little better then. You know, and so I was there for my freshman year of high school, and I was so angry that year. I got drug tested and urinalysis weekly. I couldn't do anything, nothing at all. And I remember, you know, they talk about irritable, restless, and discontent, and that was my first experience with that. And I remember just feeling rage, like, for no reason. I'm like 15 years old. There's nothing going on in my life except for I'm in this mental institution for high school. I mean, but there's no stress in my life. Like, I just have to go to school. That's it. And I remember the pressure being on me. And, you know, I made it about 6 months. I went into another hospital for an eating disorder. And I only say, I know these are outside things, but I say this because I believe all of this stuff is a manifestation of what's wrong with me, the spiritual malady that's in me. And so I went into this place for an eating disorder, and I got diagnosed with this eating disorder and possible alcoholism. I was there for 30 days and, you know, got everything together. I looked the way I wanted to look. That's also been a big thing for me. If you can just make the outside look right, everything is okay. People will leave you alone. And so I would get it together. I would get out. Everybody would be good with me. My family was happy. Everything was great. I'd get out after 30 days, and it would start all over again. The madness would come on me, you know. I would get out. I was at that institution. I begged my parents to let me go back to high school, and that's really where my drinking started again. And you know, I had them believing that it was this place I was going to high school, that if I could just go be around normal people, everything would be okay. And they wanted to believe it. They really wanted to believe it, and so they let me go back to high school. And the other thing about me is I can pretty much fit in wherever I am. If you're a football player, I will fit in with you. If you are, we used to call them freaks and jocks. If you're a freak, I will fit in with you. I will be whatever you want me to be. Just give me alcohol. I will tell you whatever you want to hear. I'll be whoever you want me to be. And I did that, and I could fit wherever I needed to fit. And I got out, and I started hanging out with the people who I could get the most alcohol from, which for some reason were the football players. And I started hanging out with them, and I could get alcohol pretty much whenever I wanted to. And I started drinking as much as I could and as often as I could. I'm a blackout drinker. I swear I can pretty much smell alcohol, and I am in a blackout, which may be a good thing because I don't know that I want to know everything that I did when I was drinking. I really believe that alcohol was my solution. Alcohol is what got me through those years. Alcohol was what made it okay that I could breathe. Again, you hear people saying, you know, they took that drink and they could take that deep breath in. And I was so awkward inside of myself, and it was like when I drank, it was just okay. I could talk to people. I didn't care what you thought. I was always so concerned what people thought of me. And I didn't care. I didn't care at all. I cared once I sobered up, but I didn't care when I was drunk. So I started drinking a lot. I started getting invited to all the parties and doing all that stuff. You know, 6 months in, I'm back in an institution. This time for drugs and alcohol. And this time I'm being diagnosed with alcoholism. And I was there for 2 weeks, and I told the I don't know how this happened, but I asked the counselors if we could go to a meeting in my hometown, and they said okay, and we went there, and I ended up running from the meeting. And then I got out, and I begged my parents to just let me come home, and I promise it'll be different this time. And they still want to believe me. They want to believe that it's going to be different this time. And so I do it again. You know, I get out. Everything looks good. Everything's great. I'm not drinking. Everything's good. Get my friends back. Everything's good. Every 6 months for 4 years, I'm in a different institution. And it starts getting old. My parents start losing hope. They start losing faith. But the one thing I can see, you know, you never know how God's working in your life. And that time that I went in for the drugs and alcohol, my dad ended up coming, and that's when my dad got sober. He came to some group that we had, and he realized that he was an alcoholic. And my mom started going to Al-Anon. So you never know. You really never know what's going to happen. I didn't end up getting sober at that point. There was still a lot more drinking for me to do. It talks about in our big book, you know, the alcoholic women are gone beyond recall in a, you know, short period of time. A lot of times, I don't know why it is for women. I don't know why. I mean, there are a lot of women that drink a long, long time. I did not. And I can tell you, by the second year, I needed to not be drinking. And I continued for a couple more years. And like I said, I don't know when I crossed that line. I have no clue when that point went from it being fun and a good time to being I needed to have alcohol. But some point in those 4 years, I absolutely crossed that line. You know, in the beginning, I guess if somebody said, you know, your life depends on you quitting, maybe I could have. I don't know. But in the beginning, there was no desire for me to. If you've ever read the chapter Two Wives, there's husband number four, and that is me. I am husband number four. I wished I was those other husbands, but I am not. And I am not the type of person that you give me a life situation and I can stop. I can tell you that I want to stop, but and everything in me will want to be done. I'll take my keys and drive my car and promise I'll be that designated driver. I'll do whatever it takes to not drink, and there I am drunk again. And I don't know why. That's part of the physical part of alcoholism, I guess, is, you know, once I put alcohol into my body, and I know you all have heard this before, but once I put it in my body, I can't stop drinking it. It creates, they talk about an allergy, and there's this tape that we listen to, we do a big book study, where he talks about the allergy. It used to confuse me a lot. I think I'm not allergic to alcohol. I don't get hives. It's not like that. But when I drink alcohol, I develop something called cravings. And that made sense to me, because once I started drinking, like I was saying, that drink number three, if I could have stopped there, I would have been good. But I could never stop at drink number three. It was always a case later, or a bottle later, or whatever it was, until I blacked out, passed out, and was throwing up somewhere. That's when I stopped. Despite all the reasons in my life to quit, despite all the evidence that drinking for me is a bad idea, I couldn't stop. And then once I stopped, my life became so painful, so painful. Again, nothing going on, but so painful on the inside that I had to have something to breathe again. And I always ended up back in that place where I'm drinking again. No clue how I got there. I drove tonight, so I wouldn't drink. Here I am drunk again. I swore it up. I wrote out these lists to my parents. I promise I will never drink alcohol again. You have my word. Here's my written contract. And there I am drunk again. And like I said, you know, it was something in my gut would tell me this is not the right thing to do. And something in me always justified the bad behavior. I believed that my drinking made it possible for that. You know, I'd have all that guilt. Of the things that I did. I did those things sober. I ran away sober. I was not drunk running away. But I drank to get rid of those feelings that I had from running away. I knew it was the wrong thing to do. I knew it was. And I put that alcohol in me, and it was okay. Everything was okay. when I was around 17 years old, you know, I had wrecked cars, I had cheated on boyfriends, I had ended up in many places I did not want to be. My parents were pretty done with me by this time. I had been in and out of all these institutions. I had been suspended from school for drinking. I had gone to prom drunk. I had left in an ambulance. People were done with me. You know, they were really done with me. I was drinking all weekend long. By Wednesday, I was shaking so bad I had to drink again. I was hiding beer in my closet and drinking before I would go to school. Because I would shake so bad from the weekend. I would do things like take Anabuse. This is so stupid looking back on it, but I would take Anabuse, which is something you give children to throw up so that they can not be poisoned when they eat poison if they do. And you used to be able to get it from CVS or wherever, and I would take that and go to work and then start throwing up at work. So it could look like I was really sick and they would send me home and then I could drink. Why even go? Like, I don't know, but I did. You know, it was about that appearance, like what people saw, what people thought. And so I would do that, and then I would go drink. By the end of my drinking, people really did not want to drink with me anymore. I was either homicidal or suicidal, usually suicidal when I drank, but it was not fun to drink with me. I was not like the life of the party. And it started to be where I would find out stuff that had gone on all weekend long and I was not invited to, like flat out lied to about, because the people really were sick of me. They just didn't want to be around it anymore. The other thing that I've found since I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous, I have had contact with people that I drank with who have gone on to be completely happy and successful in life, who drank a lot more than I drank, who did a lot worse things than I did, who are not alcoholic. So that isn't it. The things that I did when I was drinking are what make me alcoholic. And I thought that for a very long time. It's really the reaction that I have to alcohol. And that baffled me because I was like, I am certain these people are alcoholic, and they are not. They're fine, totally fine. They don't suffer from that thing I suffer from. When I came here, like I told you, I'm 18 years old. You know, I'm in my parents' house. Nobody wants to be around me. And this is where I believe that my life started. I was in my parents' house in the corner in the fetal position, sober, begging God to take my life, because I could not imagine living another 18 years the way I just lived. I really, really, really wanted to die. And I knew I was too chicken to kill myself. And I begged God to take my life. That week, I ended up going into Arlington Hospital, and I haven't had a drink since that day. And I believe that was the beginning of my new life. It talks about in the third step where we were reborn, and I think that that's where this whole process started for me. And it took me a long time to see that, you know, a long, long time. I went to this place, it was the end of the 80s, my insurance ran out because I had been in so many places that there was no money left for me. It was done. And so I ended up giving my number to somebody there who ended up calling me. And I can tell you, I've done absolutely everything you should not do if you want an easy sobriety. I've done it the hard way. And when they talk about us being stupid and stubborn, this is stupid and stubborn. Like, I am going to bang my head against that wall so many times until it's like, I'm done. Okay, I'll do it your way. And I think a lot of it, too, is that I was under the delusion that if I just quit drinking, I was going to be just fine. And if you are alcoholic, I am sorry to tell you, if you just quit drinking, you are not going to be fine. If you just quit drinking, it will eventually become so painful that you have to, at least my experience, you're either going to want to die or you're going to have to drink again or you're going to have to do something different in your life. You're going to have to find a spiritual solution to treat what's wrong. And I had no clue when I was 18. I had no clue. I thought I have friends. I have a boyfriend, finally, that actually wants to be with me. I have a pseudo-sponsor that I call sometimes. I have people to hang out with, you know, that I didn't have for a long, long time. It felt good. The fellowship felt amazing. I fell into a young people's group that stayed up all night long and hung out and did fun things. You know, life was good. And I thought that's all I had to do, go to the meeting, maybe even go inside the meeting, you know, open the big book every now and then, do something in there. I was really good at quoting things. I had page, now I can't even remember. It was like in the sixth or seventh step in the 12 and 12 where it talks about character assassination. And every time we gossiped about somebody, we would quote that little thing. And that was about the extent of it for me for about 3 years. And, you know, I had friends, I did things. And when I was around 3 years sober, what happened to me, or dry, or whatever you want to call it, not drinking, I started to go insane sober. And all those things that I had put power into in my sobriety, this boyfriend, the sponsor, this job, all this stuff left my life. And I started to go crazy in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was not treating what was wrong with me. And so I ended up going on this big road trip to Florida. I went to Georgia, and then I went to Florida with a guy, of course. And I am a runner. When things get tough, I'm gone. You know, it's like, why face life? Just get out of here. And so, you know, there's still some times today, you know, life can be stressful, and there's still some days I just want to get in my car and keep driving. I don't care where I end up. I just don't want to go wherever that is. I just keep going. And that's something that just in me, and I think alcohol gave me that too. You know, when I drank, life just did not matter. And so that's what I wanted to do. And I moved down to Florida with this guy who was selling meat out of the back of a truck. And we lived in this apartment. And, you know, when I was down there, I ended up getting a sponsor who was very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she started taking me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the beginning of it for me. It was the first time that I understood. I was driving past this liquor store, and I had, up until that point, I thought, it's liquid, it's a beverage, this is retarded, how can I be powerless over a beverage? That makes no sense. And I was driving past the liquor store, and I knew to the core of my being that if I stopped in there and got a drink, this madness would be off of me. And that was the first time that I understood what was going on. And I started to understand that if I was going to stay sober, that I was actually going to have to start taking actions here, that I couldn't just be an honorary member and show up when I wanted to and come here for the guys or whatever it was I was coming here for, that I was actually going to have to start doing something. And I started getting busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my life started taking off. I started to... For me, working with new people was the absolute most unbearable thing in the world. It was so unbelievably painful for people to talk to me about themselves. Like, it really was. Like, I would get physical reactions to it because I was so used to just thinking about me and me and more me. You know, somebody would come to me for help, and I'd be like, I cannot deal with this. Like, the break in me. And then... that bondage of self got so painful that break in me became something that I looked forward to. I remember being on my bedroom floor and, again, in this place where I'm begging God to please relieve me of this bondage and the people that started flooding into my life, the women, really, that started coming into my life that I started working with. Most of them are not here today, but so many people that I've met here that... you know, come to me for help. And these women started asking me for help. And so I had to start doing something if I was going to tell them to be doing something. And what a relief. What a relief. And what I think that's the way we get better, really. You know, they help me far more than I will ever help them. And they are my mirror. And, you know, I'll be complaining about things they do. And it's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, there I am. And anyways, these women started coming into my life, and I started getting busy helping people, and that bondage of self started coming off of me. And I don't know if you all get this, but when you are massively self-centered, your life takes forever. It is like every day is painfully long, and everything goes by so slow. But when you start getting out of yourself and becoming other-centered, God-centered, your life starts taking off. And that's what started happening to me. So things started taking off. I had never wanted to do anything with my life. I was a high school dropout. Really, my aspirations were to sit on a porch, smoke cigarettes, and drink beer. Like, that was it. That's as far as it got. I had a sponsor who wanted more from me than I ever wanted for myself, who he didn't ask me. He actually told me that I was going to be self-supporting through my own contributions, that I was not going to marry a man to take care of myself, that men can leave at any point, and I was going to be able to support myself. And, you know, at the time, I was like, whatever. And I'm so glad that I did that. I am really so glad that I did that, because I can take care of myself. I can take care of my kids. I am totally and completely self-supporting. I don't have to rely on my parents. I don't have to rely on my husband. And that's I don't know what that is, but that is a really good feeling that I can do that, that I can put money in the basket, that I can take care of myself. And he had me start going to school, which I never thought I would do. So I got my GED, and when I had lived in Florida. So I lived in Florida and did all this self-will stuff, got a sponsor, started going through the book, and ended up coming back to this area that I was very resentful at most of the people here in AA for doing whatever they did to me. And I ended up coming back here and getting a sponsor here. And so he had me start going to school. And I decided I was going to be a nurse, which... somebody had planted that idea in my head when I was down there, and I really didn't think I could do it. Like, I really believed from a very early age. I'd gotten held back when I was in second grade, and I dropped out of high school, and I really believed that I was stupid, that I couldn't do it. And I made a lot of decisions in my life based off of that idea. And, you know, there's so many things that we believe in ourselves that we take actions based off of those old ideas that, and I believed that. I truly believed it. And so I started going to school to prove them wrong, and ended up actually doing very well. And so I became a nurse, and I met a man, and I got married. And in my mind, I thought, you know, if you have all these things, you're doing well, you know. You get married, you have some kids, you buy a house, you get some cars, you're doing great. And I guess I was around 10, 15 years sober. And my life had gotten really, really good in Alcoholics Anonymous, really good. I was busy. I was sponsoring people. I was sponsored. I was active. And then all these things started happening. You know, I got this career. I have these kids. And slowly I started pulling away from the thing that got me all those, that made my life that good. Not that your life is not good without all those things, because it is. Life is an amazing thing, but I had put so much on, those things were going to make me happy. I started stepping out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started having, we were talking about this before, you know, I have these two little kids, I can't get to the meeting, you know, get down to two meetings a week. I don't really need to call my sponsor, you know, they know what's going on. My sponsor ended up getting really sick with cancer and dying, and I had backed out so far. You know, they talk about complacency being in the middle of danger, but you feel like you're okay. And that's how I felt. Like, I had no clue how close I was to drinking. I really had no clue. I thought everything was fine. And again, that thing that happens to us when you are not treating what's wrong with you. I got to this place where I was close to 20 years sober, where drinking started to look like it might not be a bad idea because I could not stand the way it felt anymore. And I'm very grateful for this experience today. You know, when my sponsor died, he died at home. And I remember going there and looking at him, his body, when I remember thinking that it's just a shell. There's nothing there. Where does that go? There's no God. There's nothing. And my world got really, really dark. Really dark. And trying to stay sober with no God is not a fun thing. Really not a fun thing. And so I started, you know, it took a while for me to get to this place, but, you know, things started happening in my life. I had a couple of miscarriages. Life stuff happened to me, and I got really mad at God. Really, really mad at God. And it got so painful that I had to go back to God, is what happened. But I started looking at things like dinosaurs, which, this is silly, but I started going back in time. And the thought came to me that whatever that is a lot bigger than me, because I cannot make any of that on my power. And whatever that is, I can maybe believe in. And it started there. It was just a little bit of hope that maybe there's something else. When that sponsor died, I stayed away for a while. And I started to get really, really sick. My marriage ended, and I got really close to drinking. And I lost everything in my life. Sorry, Tracy and I were listening to this thing before that I listened to back then that kind of brought all this back to me. But I ended up at a point in my sobriety where I was, you know, my kids, I had them less than half time. I had to move into my own apartment. I left my house. I left everything that I knew. All my friends were gone. It was a really, really low point in my life. And I remember getting to this point where I had to surrender to everything, the good and the bad. I had to give it up. And I got the sponsor who would not be my God, who forced me to find a God. And thank God for her. Thank God. And she got me back into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, which has saved my life. Because nothing on the outside is going to fix what's wrong with me. Nothing. It doesn't matter if I'm married, if I have kids, if I have the best clothes, if I have no clothes, if I have a job, don't have a job, none of that stuff. My alcoholism does not care what my circumstances are in my life. My alcoholism cares what I'm doing to treat it. And I truly believe that, you know, it's like, I always use this analogy, and I don't think it's not the same, but, you know, if you're diabetic and you take your insulin, you're okay. You're usually okay. For the most part. Being alcoholic, when I take the actions here, when I apply the spiritual principles that are outlined in this book, when I'm using my God, I'm usually okay. I can get by okay in this world. When I'm not doing those things, I become real sick. I don't have to drink to be real, real sick. And that's what happened to me. And she got me back into this book, and she got me to a place where I could find a God. And I started taking these actions again. And for the first time in my entire sobriety, 20 years, 20 plus years, I did an inventory, and it was not your fault. And my inventory was not about what you did to me. My inventory for the first time ever was about how I set people up, how I manipulate people, my inventory, not yours. And I didn't get that. I don't know why I didn't get that. Like, I would write down my four columns and my part, but my part was always, what you did to me is why I did this. It was never my part is why I resent you for this. And she took me back through it, and we went through the third step, and I could see if people only did and acted as I wished, I would be just fine. I would not have any of these resentments. Life would be good. If you would just do it the way I said it was okay to do, then we would be good. And that gave me such freedom to see that I'm the one that's wrong. And it doesn't matter if other people are wrong, because I can't do anything about anyone else. All I have to do is know what I am doing here, where my part is here, where I'm wrong. And the freedom, actually, she wouldn't let me say my part because that does imply they have a part. So I was not allowed to say that, but I was allowed to look at my part. And the, God, I had never had that freedom to not blame anyone else for what's wrong with me. I had never had that experience of getting down to what it actually is in me that's causing all this. And the bottom line for me is I'm afraid. It might come across as anger. It might come across as arrogance. It might come across as a lot of different things. But I am terrified. I am terrified of being alone. I'm afraid that there is no God. I'm afraid that this is it. And, you know, when I could get down to really what I'm afraid of here, it opened up so many doors for me. I started to be able to, that conscious contact I talk about, I started to have moments of like feeling that presence of something else, that it was going to be okay regardless of whatever goes on in my life, because life is going to happen. And I really thought if I had God and AA, that life wasn't going to happen to me. I don't know where I got that idea from, that bad things weren't going to happen if I'm sober. But life continues to happen, and Alcoholics Anonymous and my God give me the strength to get through those things. And through doing this whole process, I was able to accept a lot of stuff about myself that's not pretty and share that with somebody else and know that even though I can tell somebody this, first of all, I think that was probably one of the most important things. For a long time, I had a sponsor I was terrified of, and I finally had a sponsor where I could expose myself completely to. Tell you the good, the bad, and the ugly, and go from there to show her myself, and then go into the eighth and ninth step and truly make these amends and be different. I could go, like, for a long time, and I would go to people and at my parents especially, I could say I'm sorry and then go act like the same jerk that had just come to them, you know. Nothing had changed. I wanted to be different. I wanted the relationship to, I wanted to feel better is what I wanted to feel. And when I hear people all this, can I just do my fourth and fifth step? Sure, you can do your fourth and fifth step, but there's a lot that's going to go into this fourth and fifth step. It's not just a quick fix of me feeling better. You know, there's a lot of stuff that I got to get down to here. And I had to get to the place where I was going knowing that the saying I'm sorry is not the hard part. The being different is the hard part. And that has continued to be, you know, for me, that I go to these people and I make the amends. I ask them if there's anything that I am not seeing, because I don't see a lot, and what I can do to make it right with them. For a long time, I was telling them what I was going to do to make it right, you know, and I ask them now what I can do. And I truly believe that's where this connection, this power that I need desperately to stay sober, I started to get in touch with through the eighth and ninth step. And I need that power desperately today. I need it. Like I said, my world got so dark without that. You know, I started going through these amends and continuing to keep my stuff clean. I had this experience where I was in a meeting and I had shared something about one of the girls I sponsor. She was sitting right next to me and I had kind of belittled her in the meeting with her there and hurt her feelings really badly. And afterwards, you know, I apologized because I felt really bad. I knew what I did. And as I'm driving home, I'm like, I'm going to send her a text. I'm going to call her. I'm going to do all these things. And I took out my big book and I read the part in here, you know, and it goes through very detailed, really, about what we do, you know, as we're retiring at night. And it doesn't say in there we pester them till they forgive us, you know, which is what I want to do. You know, I do something wrong, and I want you to be okay with me. And it was okay if she was not okay with me. She had every right to be upset with me. And, you know, I made my amends to her. I went to my sponsor and told her what I did, and then I went to my God and asked him to please help me be different. And that was the first time for me where it was like, I mean, I'd done lots of 10 steps. I don't want to say it's the first time, but where I got it, like, it's, you don't have to be right with me for me to be okay, for me to continue to go on here and not go into that self-loathing, which I always did, that I make mistakes. I'm human. I make mistakes today. I am far from perfect, far from perfect. I am not right a lot of days, and I probably never will be 100% right, but it's a lot better than it used to be, you know, a lot better. And I continue to seek. I don't know, you know, I feel like it really is like an onion. Like, I don't know. I'm not there yet with my God. I continue to seek. I continue to try new things. I go where I'm pushed. I had a sponsor one time that would say, go where it's warm. And that's what I try to do. I believe my God opens doors for me. And I have no idea what it's going to look like. And for the longest time, I needed to know what it was going to look like. I have no clue. I have no clue. I show up. I try to be of use to somebody throughout the day. I try not to hurt anybody. And I try to do the best I can. And a lot of days, I fall real short of that. But it's a whole lot better than it used to be. And like I had mentioned earlier, the bright side of my life really is the women in my life. Other alcoholics, I should say. I love talking about alcoholism. I love talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. My husband and I will spend hours talking about different things here. I mean, it is my life. One of the things I see when people are starting to go out is they start saying that AA gets in the way of their life. And I hope that never happens for me, because there is no way I could have a life without Alcoholics Anonymous. There is no way. I do not function well on my own. I've told you where I go. I will be in an institution very quickly, probably within 6 months, and it will not be good. So I don't know. I'm very grateful for my sobriety, for Alcoholics Anonymous, for you people, and I hope I never forget where I came from and that I always remain in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have I've been sober almost 26 years, and I'll tell you, I don't see it as much with the men, but it is very hard for me to find active women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know what that is. I don't know why, but in the area I am, it's very hard for me to find people that have continued to do this. And I don't know what happens, because I'll tell you what happens to me, and it ain't pretty. and I don't think that they're all drunk. I just don't know where they are. But I hope that I always remain visible and in the middle of this thing, because my life depends on this. I truly believe that today. And I think that's about it out of me. I am really grateful to be here tonight, and thank you, Billy.